There was one particular plant that I saw that was made resistant to 5 antibiotics at the same time. So, right, we've skipped a couple forward. I haven't got one here. I'll try it on here. Nope, we're going forward. No. Right, now we know where we are. Right, so what are GM crops designed to do? You've probably heard stories about how we're going to, how they're going to make it drought tolerant and saline tolerant and do all sorts of really quite marvellous things in these crops. But the reality is that the vast majority of these that have been made so far have been designed to do one of two things, really. And the first one is to be, they make the plant resistant to a herbicide so that now you can spray the crop in the field and the plant itself, the crop, will live while the weeds around it die. And the main herbicide that they make this resistant to is glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup. So that is the most common developed. The other one is designed to create a new protein which makes the plant resistant to being eaten by insects because the plant now makes its own insecticide. So instead of now being able to wash off any residual insecticide that you might have on your plant when you take it home, such as broccoli, what actually happens is it's in every cell of the plant and you can't actually wash it off. And there are quite a few crops now on supermarket shelves where both of these are what's called stacked into the plant, where you get one GM crop, another GM crop of the same type, like one GM variety of corn, another GM variety of corn, and another GM variety of corn, and you cross them so that now you might have a triple stacked plant, and you've actually got then 3 GM genes into the plant. And these multi-stack plants are becoming really quite common. So let's look at the safety of these crops by actually looking at the gold standard of how you assess the safety of crops, and that is the clinical trial. And this occurs with, say, a new pharmaceutical drug. And the pharmaceutical industry has learnt to do this because some of their pharmaceutical drugs have, of course, had rather unfortunate endpoints in human beings. So this is now the standard way of testing a pharmaceutical crop. What you do first is you go to animals and you thoroughly safety assess it in animals. You work out what the risks and the benefits are in animals. Then you move to human trials, and as Lauren Pang was talking about before, there are 4 phases of a human clinical trial. You start off with phase 1, where you get a small number of healthy volunteers and you feed them the new pharmaceutical drug and you see what untoward effects there might be. If it passes that stage, it goes into phase 2, where you look for the expected benefit and see whether it actually occurs. Again, small numbers of people. And then you go to phase 3, which is the randomised controlled trial, and that is now large numbers of people. And Lauren was talking about one with many thousands of people in a vaccine trial. They're generally at least hundreds of people and often into the thousands. And some of them are multi-centred studies where you have many different universities or hospitals from around the world to get enough patients to be able to do this sort of study properly. Then if it gets into the human pharmaceutical supply, then often they are monitored in the community to see if something untoward might be happening that you couldn't pick up in all of the other studies. And these days there's also often another step that occurs after it's been released into the community to take, and that is this meta-analysis where they'll get a number of these and join them all together to get a measure of the overall effect. So where in this sort of safety process do you think GM crops are? Well, let's have a look at where we are in these things. This is my food safety regulator. It's Food Standards Australia, New Zealand, so it's a regulator shared between 2 countries. And I looked at 12 of their reports. So when a GM crop company wants to try and bring in a new GM crop into Australia and New Zealand, they are required to provide my regulator with certain information. My regulator then looks at that information and writes a report of about 70 pages. And I'm looking at 12 such reports covering 28 GM crops. And what I want to do is I want to work out what a regulator requires in safety testing, what the GM crop company actually does and how that compares to the gold standard. Now, there are four main things I think that need to be assessed in GM crops, and they are allergies. And by looking at these reviews, by reviewing all of these studies by my regulator, I can tell you that the allergies are only assessed theoretically, and I can give you more information if anyone wants to ask a question. But there are no animal feeding studies and there are no human testing, no animal testing and no human testing on humans to determine the allergenicity of the new protein that they want that plant to make. Animals are not fed for long enough for cancers to develop, so therefore there is no testing for cancer. There are no reproductive studies required at all before it's fed to people for generations. So this is determining whether it has any effect on the reproductive ability of the animal or person, and also what effect it may actually have on the unborn. You know, do the children or rat pups come out looking a little strange? It's just not assessed at all. There is some assessing for toxicity. So this is, does it affect your organs badly, such as your heart or your liver or your kidneys? And I will go into those soon. But really the only thing that Fasance requires is this compositional comparison and substantial equivalence. And Lauren was just talking about that and giving a very good, I think, overview of just how that is supposed to be the beginning of a review of the safety of these foods, when in fact this is all my regulator requires. So whilst they also say, oh, it's only the beginning of what we look at, in reality when it comes to safety assessing, it's all they need. So what they do here with substantial equivalence is they get a small number of the GM plants, of the GM crop that they're actually making, and a small number of plants are from a similar sort of crop. So we're talking about GM corn, they'll get some non-GM corn equivalent, and they will look at the composition of those crops, of those plants. Now, the problem here is, manifold. First of all, what do you look at in the composition? If the GM plant's going to do something unusual and make something new, it is likely to be a protein. And if it makes a new protein, that's the thing that could cause an allergy or could cause some sort of toxic effect. So you'd think, therefore, that they'd have a really good look at the proteins that are produced. No. What they do is they get the proteins and they knock them down into their building blocks, which are the amino acids, and they compare those. Now, that's a little bit like comparing the safety of this building with the one next door, not by looking at the exits or the escape plans or where the fire hydrants are or whatever, but knocking the buildings down and counting the bricks. So you can see that all of the relevant information has just been lost. So that's what the amino acids are. They're the building blocks of the proteins. Now, sometimes they might measure the fats and actually look at the fatty acids, which are the components of the fat. But that, I have seen that so often not done. Sometimes they might look for anti-nutrients, and these might be things like trypsin inhibitor in soy. But for all of these, the key thing here is they're very small sample sizes. Now, there is a problem in statistics whereby if you have small sample sizes and you're relying upon finding statistically significant findings as something that says, yes, there's something going on, which is how science works. Science doesn't operate on, oh, this was up 10% and that wasn't. It says you've got to have a statistically significant difference in that in order for people to sit up and take notice, in order for it to be relevant, in fact. When you've got small sample sizes, it becomes very, very hard to find statistically significant differences for things that are biologically really important. So you could have something major going on biologically, but small sample sizes will prevent you from finding anything that is statistically significant. It becomes very, very hard to find. Then when they actually reported their statistical information, it was pretty clear that not all of the stuff they needed to report was there. There were some major gaps in the way that they were reporting. Now, the other main thing here is that there's actually no definition of statistical significance. So, you know, how do you break the speed law? By knowing what the speed limit is and then going over the top of it, right? So if there is no speed limit, how can you break the speed laws? So that no definition of substantial equivalence, you can't not be substantially not significant, not different, you know. Everything becomes substantially equivalent because there's no fail. You can't fail. And in fact, for one corn variety, which is in American fields quite widely, either as just that gene or stacked into a multistat corn variety, almost half the amino acids were statistically significantly different, even on really small sample sizes. And my food regulator and other food regulators said, ah, that's okay, it's substantially equivalent, it's safe for you to eat for generations. And that's the only thing they require, as I said. What they don't need, therefore, are animal studies or human studies or, in fact, any review of the raw data. So a GM company might, for example, give raw data to my food regulator, but my food regulator has a policy that says we don't need to look to see if there's anything else in the raw data that the company hasn't told us about. Now, if you've got these stacked crops where you've got more than one gene, GM gene, stacked into the crop, there's even less required for that. So if a food regulator has said, look, this GM gene in corn, we've approved it as safe to eat, that GM gene in corn is safe to eat, that one in corn is safe to eat, you can cross those in however many combinations you feel like doing, and there is not even a substantial equivalence test required on the stacked crop. Because as far as they're concerned, there is no possibility that those genes or the protein products from them are going to interact. There's the assumption that they cannot do that. Now, we know from pharmaceutical drugs that they can interact. We've learnt that long and hard, but not apparently possible for crops. And this is, of course, it's a concern, because last year, 3/4 of US corn varieties were stacked with both this herbicide-tolerant and this insecticidal-tolerant genes. That they're the genes that the BT genes are the ones that make it resistant to being eaten. They're the insecticidal ones. Now, sometimes they do some animal feeding studies. So these are the things that the industry does to give to the regulator to say, look, it's safe. Please bring it into the food supplier. And my regulator will look at those and regulators around the world and go, yes, that looks absolutely fine. We'll bring it into the food supplier. So for 2/3 of all of those crops I reviewed, this was the only thing done. What they do is they say, we've genetically engineered this corn, this soy, to produce this protein. So what we're going to do is we're going to get that protein, and just that protein, not the crop, we're going to get that protein, we're going to put it down the throats of some rats, just one dose, no more, just one, and we're going to see if they die in the next 7 to 14 days. And if they survive, hey, that means it's safe for you to eat for generations. It's perfectly fine. So what are the problems with this? Well, numerous. First of all, there's the assumption that that GM crop is only going to produce that protein and nothing else is going to happen. Nothing unusual is going to be produced. The other thing is that there's this assumption that the plant-produced protein acts the same way as that from a bacteria, because you see, they don't actually put the protein from the plant in the throats of the rats. What they do is they genetically engineer a bacteria to produce what they hope is the same protein, and they put that down the throats of some rats. Now, the problem with that is that sometimes, well, plants are far more sophisticated creatures than bacteria, and they can do things to the structure and function of those proteins after they're made, by, for example, putting sugar units on them that might increase the allergenicity. And bacteria can't do that, but they test the protein by the bacteria. And the other, of course, important thing is that it is going to create disease within 14 days, isn't it? And if it doesn't, if it creates disease in 15 days, I'm sorry, but it's safe to eat, because the test only goes for 14 days. And as I said, this was the only testing done for 2/3 of all of those that I reviewed. Now, sometimes the industry will feed the actual, like, corn kernel or the actual soybean to animals. But the traditional, the standard way that they do this is what they will do is they will get those and they'll feed them to what I call farm animals under animal production study processes. So also important here is that if, for example, you've got Roundup Ready soybeans, and when they come into the human food supply, they will be sprayed, because otherwise why would you spend all that money spending that extra money buying genetically modified seeds to be used with Roundup, and then you don't use the Roundup, right? So they're going to be sprayed. But in these studies, they weren't sprayed. They just decided to feed them to animals unsprayed. So it's not the same as you will be eating or you are eating. They have what I regard as unusual health models and unusual measurements of human health. So basically, they will do things such as they'll get some chickens and they'll feed the chickens the GM feed, and they will then report things such as did they live or did they die, the death rate. They may weigh the animals, with the implication being, of course, that if they live, they must be healthy. Because they didn't die, they must be healthy. And if they then measure the body weight, because, of course, the bigger you are, the fatter you are, the healthier you are. And then they might measure breast meat, because that's really important for human health, right? So therefore, men, I'm really sorry, but you cannot be as healthy as women because your breasts aren't as big. That's how important it is for human health. And if they feed it to cows, for example, they might measure milk production. So men, now, if you start growing breasts and getting milk from your breasts, then you are definitely healthy. So you can see that they're not really designed to measure human health at all. In fact, really what they're designed to do is to reassure farmers that if they feed this to their animals will live, they will gain weight, and they will make milk, grow big breasts, and they will be able to sell them for a good price at market. And yet my food authority takes these studies as evidence that they're as nutritious and wholesome as ordinary non-GM food. And I should also say that with the animals that they choose, something like chickens, I mean, how physiologically similar are you to chickens? I mean, chickens have feathers, they fly, they lay eggs, they don't suckle their young. They have two stomachs, they swallow grit to help grind their food, and their kidneys do not produce urine. Does that describe you? I mean, how dissimilar is it possible to get? Oh, they also feed it to fish, because obviously you're very similar to a fish. You can breathe underwater without drowning. So industry animal feeding studies, now sometimes they actually do what I regard to be a proper toxicology study. Now, toxicology studies need to be done on proper, you know, animals that are, you know, regarded as toxicological studies. So we're talking here about the lab rat, okay? So sometimes they'll feed it to animals longer than we've seen before. The longest really that they go for is 90 days these days sometimes. In all of the ones that I looked at, not one went any longer than a month. And they will actually measure some things that are relevant to human health, but this type of study is uncommon. And really, if you're only feeding it to animals for 1 month to 3 months, it's still not long enough for adverse effects to develop, because it's not long enough for cancers to grow. So therefore, you've got no measure of cancer, no reproductive studies still, so no measure of that. And the number of animals are too low. So if you've got 20 rats in a group and you're measuring death, which is often all they measure, even when in a toxicology study, then that means that a quarter of the rats in one group have to die and none in the other before you reach statistical significance. If you've got 10 rats in a group, then half of them have got to die and none in the other before you reach statistical significance. So if you've got 20 rats in a group and 20% die, that's fine. It's healthy. You see, hasn't reached statistical significance, so you can now eat it. Now, if that was replicated in the human population, that would be a fairly important thing to avoid, I would think. But you can see how poorly set up they are, how really they're not really designed to be really trying to pick up any sort of adverse effects. You know, if they're only measuring the body weights and the death rates, then obviously the heavier you are, the healthier you are. If a death rate, well, obviously if you're not dead, you must be healthy. So if you've got cancer and you're alive, hey man, you're healthy. If you've got, awful autoimmune diseases or, you know, chronic conditions going on, or diabetes or, heart disease, if you're not dead, you're fine, according to these studies. Sometimes they might actually inspect organs, but rarely. And if they do, they might weigh the organs without actually cutting them open and having a look inside, because they're assuming, obviously, that if it's a diseased organ, it's got to weigh less than a healthy organ, and that's not the case. Not always. They may these days do actual blood biochemistry, so this is where they might take a bit of blood and actually look at a sort of standard biochemistry screen, as you would if you go to the doctor. But in the ones I looked at, there wasn't a single one of those mentioned. And if they do find adverse effects, and they do sometimes, then they don't investigate further. So, for example, with Roundup Ready canola, What they did there was they got the seeds from the canola, they crushed them, and the oil comes out and you eat it. And then the bit that's left behind, the seed husk, is called canola meal, and that gets fed to farm animals. So which bit do you think they fed to animals in a toxicological study? The oil? Nah. They fed the seed husks. And when they did so, they found that there was an increase in the liver weight of between about 12 and 16%. And they said, that's all right. They came up with some excuse. They didn't bother to investigate it any further. And this has been published in a University of New South Wales Press book. So this is a chapter in a book about genetic engineering, genetic modification. Now, you're in the United States, aren't you? You know, you've got some of the best government in the world. You must have a better system, don't you? No requirements. My government's got requirements. Yours doesn't. My regulator has requirements that every GM food that comes in that they want to bring into Australia has to go through them, as badly as you've seen the, you know, what they do. Your government has none of that. Your FDA is a completely voluntary system. So a GM crop company doesn't even have to tell the FDA that it's going to bring out a new GM crop for you to eat. Now, in reality, the companies do tell the FDA. Now, if they tell the FDA, you would therefore think that the FDA would do a thorough assessment and come out with an assessment, a determination that it was safe. But that's not what happens. What happens is the FDA may have some questions, ask of the company. At the end of the process, they'll say, thank you, we have no more questions. And we, the FDA, understand that you, the company, says it's safe. Okay? Doesn't ever say, we say it's safe. And therefore, if something does go wrong, it's actually the company that could be sued. It's my understanding and the understanding of many others as well. Now, I'll get on to the pig study shortly, the study that we actually did. But in the meantime, we got hassled about that because we didn't actually get tissues, slices of tissues from the pigs and look at them under a microscope. So we went, okay, you know, there were people associated with the industry who said those things. So therefore, we did a review to see how many of those sorts of studies were actually done. So this is where you get to a histopathology study is where you get animals, you feed the crop to them, you get small pieces of their organs out, you slice them finely, and you look at them under a microscope to see if there's anything wrong happening there. And we looked at three common GM genes. So this is the Roundup Ready gene and two of those insecticidal BT proteins. And we looked, histopathology is traditionally done on rats. That certainly is the OECD standard. So we looked at rat studies. They had to be done for, you know, 90 days or longer so that they were consistent with each other. And we had a look and we found that of three of the most common GM genes, looking in the digestive tract because that's where the protein goes most of the for the longest period of time and generally because you need your stomach and your intestines. We found 47 crop varieties that had one or two or three of those GM genes in it. And we found that there were no published studies for 81% of them, not one. That's not at the time they were assessed to be safe, but that's at any time. So 19% of them actually had a histopathology study done, but of those ones, three quarters of them were done after the crop was approved to come into animal or human food, with half of them at least 9 years. So really what that means is that the crops are being assessed as safe to eat at a time when there are no published histopathology studies, and on most of those crops, none will ever be done and published, and if they are, they're often done 9 years after you've been eating them. And what was even worse here was we found not a single study was properly conducted. So there were things said such as, oh, we're going to feed it to these animals and we're going to look at three organs, and then they only give you the results for one organ. Or they go, oh, we didn't find anything wrong without saying what they looked at. Or a definition of what they found to be toxic before they said we didn't find anything toxic. So it's that speed limit thing again, you know? If there's no speed limit, if they don't tell you what the speed limit is, then how do you know they didn't break it? Or they found actual toxic findings and then just dismissed them. So we came to the conclusion that there was a complete lack of evidence that the crops are safe to eat, and this has been published in a very high-end international journal. Now, all of these are also found on the GMO Duty Carmen website, and I'll give you that address later on. And whenever we publish a study, there's not only the scientific paper, which is, you know, highly scientific and you may find difficult to read, but we also put out a one-page clear English statement about what we did, what we found and what it means. And that's written for people with just a high school education. Now, there's another type of crop that's coming in that I need to inform you about. So I've been talking about the traditional sorts of GM crops where you alter the DNA to produce a new type of protein. In this, it's different. What they're doing is they're altering the DNA so that the plant now produces what's called an RNA molecule. And we're talking about the double-stranded, that's that little DS up there, is double-stranded RNA molecules. Now, there's a view that these should be fairly easily broken down in the environment and in humans and animals because, well, it's RNA that's not very stable. But when people do that, they're actually talking about messenger RNA, which is a different type of RNA. These are much more stable in the environment and also in things like when they're digested. So one type here is in plants. Now, this is my government research body. It's a government and industry sort of co-joined research body called the CSIRO. A division of them is actually making double-stranded RNA plants whereby the piece of double-stranded RNA silences a gene in the plant so that a different type of starch is made that is takes longer to digest, so it gets all the way down into your large bowel with the hope and the aim that it will actually then be fermented in the large bowel and actually hopefully improve the chances of people not getting bowel cancer. There'll also be lower glycemic index. There's another type where that's put into a plant is actually genetically engineered to make a double-stranded RNA so that that's in the plant. An insect comes along, eats the plant. The double-stranded RNA goes into the gut of the grub, survives digestion, goes into the tissues and silences a gene in the insect that kills the insect. There also are moves to actually, instead of making the plant genetically engineer it, just to spray it on the crop instead. So it's like an insecticidal spray. And once again, as I said, these are fairly well difficult to break down in the environment. They tend to be fairly long-lived in the environment. And then you've got problems with runoff into streams and getting into soil and into other organisms in the environment in that way. Now, this is a very early area of investigation to try and work out what these double-stranded RNAs do to the health of insects, animals and people, and yet they're already starting to come out in our food supply. But what we know already from this is that there are some plants that produce these double-stranded RNAs and they're not designed to survive digestion like these things are, and yet they can still be found in the blood of people. We also know that they can change gene expression in mice, in human cells in tissue culture, and at least in worms they can be inherited. So given all of this, you would think that there would be some really good safety assessments of these sorts of crops, wouldn't you? Well, we looked at three different government regulators in three countries to see what they did, and they did not consider it at all. Or if they did, they just assumed that it was safe. So there was no assessment done on these things for a new, you know, GM crop that produces a double-stranded RNA. And once again, we've published this in a very high-end journal. We've also given a plan, if you like, for how we think regulators should actually regulate these crops. But there's a particular concern for that CSIRO wheat. Well, not only, you know, for the plants that actually produce those insecticidal double-stranded RNAs, there is therefore a risk that it might, you know, when you eat the plant, that it might survive digestion in you and actually affect the operation of some of your genes. But in the CSIRO wheat, there's a particular problem there that I'm concerned about, and that is that there are no animal studies planned. And there are some human studies planned. However, they do not intend to do the animal studies before the human studies. And when they do the animal studies or the human studies, there is no intention to look for harm. The only intention is to look to see if it has that beneficial effect that they hope it's going to have. So if it does cause problems to the livers or the kidneys or whatever, they're not going to pick it up because they're not looking. And, you know, that bit of a worry for this lot because This gene they're trying to silence in the barley and the wheat, you and I have a similar gene in us, which we need in order to live. And in fact, there are some people who are born with that gene very much silenced because they're born without that gene operating, and those people die by the age of 5. So you'd think that they would, you know, have a good look at this and actually make sure that they fed it to animals before they fed it to humans, that they would go looking for harmful effects as well. Because if it does come into the human food supply, if it does silence that gene in you, then you could be very ill indeed. So what happens when you exceed these rather, I think, as you would agree, inadequate sort of methods? So what we did here was we're now going back to talk about the standard sort of GM crops that are made, that are designed to make a new protein. We've now got, and this is published once again, we've now got a long-term study. It's a toxicology study. We've got it on pigs because they're physiologically comparable to humans, and we're going to feed them a combined diet of GM soy and GM maize, and we've got stacked varieties here. So this is a real-world study because this is how you eat the food as well. You eat it as a mixture of a variety of different types of GM plants, and you're also eating stacked varieties, and pigs are a fairly good model for humans, particularly for their digestive system. Now, another reason for picking pigs is that, you know, these crops have been fed in ever-increasing amounts into farm animals in the United States and at higher levels than you are currently eating. And when it's fed to farm animals, they're fed mixtures and they're fed quite a lot of it as part of their diet. So for pigs, for example, almost all of their diet is a combination of GM soy and GM maize for most pigs in the US. So you'd think that if something was going to be found as an adverse effect of feeding GM feed, this would be where you might be able to pick it up. And Howard Vlieger, who is my colleague in the United States and who is a farmer in Iowa, so this is a combined study between Australia and the United States, came to me and said, look, we're seeing problems in pigs. And we're seeing in particular reproductive problems and digestive problems. And the reproductive problems in sows, which are the female pigs, we're seeing a reduced ability to conceive and a higher rates of miscarriage. And if boars are actually used, then we're seeing a reduction in the number of piglets born. Now, at the same time that GM crops have been coming into the US animal feed supply, at the same time, the genetics of pigs has improved because there's been an awful lot of artificial insemination, an increase in the amount of artificial insemination used. And when you use artificial insemination, you buy a straw where you are guaranteed a certain number of viable sperm. So therefore, you might be compensating for any adverse effects on male reproductive health by actually introducing GM crops. But there are still some religious communities in the United States where it's required that the boar services the sow. And in those, that's where they're seeing a reduction in the number of piglets born. But the other thing Howard was saying is that we're seeing inflammation also happening in the digestive tract of the animals, in the stomach and small intestine. And some of these digestive problems can get so bad that a pig can... The wall of the small intestine in the ileum can actually get so thin that the pig can go down in a screaming heap and die within about 15 minutes because the wall got so thin it ruptured. So he's saying that we're seeing these problems in our pig herds, and if you then put the animals onto a non-GM diet, they go away. You put them back onto a GM diet, the problems come back. And he's also saying that the problems may not be able to be obvious to farmers because there's been a gradual introduction of GM crops over a number of years. And it's really only the older veterinarians who are going, I don't remember that when I was younger. The younger veterinarians, this is kind of all they've seen. And so they just expect it to be normal. So with pigs, this is a commercial study. This observation that Howard made was in commercial piggeries, in commercial pigs, and so we used commercial pigs. We got them just weaned so that the first food that they had was the GM feed or not. So we got a whole pile of pigs, we split them into two groups, and we fed one lot a mixed GM soy and GM corn diet, and the other lot was a non-GM diet equivalent. The males are neutered at 3 days of age, so unfortunately we can't go looking at in them to see what their reproductive health might be. And that's to stop the meat tasting of boar taint, which is unpleasant to a lot of consumers. They were fed for 23 weeks, which is the commercial lifespan. So I think it's about 5 months, which is much longer than the sort of 90-day studies that the industry may sometimes do these days. Equal numbers of boys and girls, individually followed, and there were a lot of things that were monitored daily, such as their food and their water and their if they had any diarrhea and all sorts of things. So here are piglets arriving in a modified school bus, which I had a real giggle over that. I thought that was interesting. So at this stage, they've been randomised and put into pens as youngsters. And this is when they're bigger at the growing and finishing phase. So they're about ready now to go to the abattoir or slaughterhouse, as you call it. The feed that we fed them, as I said, was a mixed soy and corn diet, which is normal for US piggery. Half of them were fed this stacked. If they were on the GM diet, it was three genes at once and their protein products, the Roundup Ready gene, and these are two of those BT genes producing BT proteins. And these are very commonly grown and eaten in the United States. The other half were fed substantially equivalent non-GM crops grown from the same area, exactly the same amount of soy and corn in them. And the feed was processed on the same equipment, so it was the same particle size. We looked for the mycotoxin content, found that that was not going to be a problem, and so on. We really did thoroughly assess it all the way through. At the end of their lifespan, they went to an abattoir or a slaughterhouse, as is normal for pigs in a commercial piggery, where the meat went into the human food supply, and we got their internal organs, and we then looked at their internal organs. So we weighed their internal organs and we examined internally certain key ones. The veterinarians who did this were blinded. That means that if they had, for example, a kidney in their hand, they did not know whether it came from a GM-fed pig or not, so they could not influence the results at all. So this is inside the abattoir. Please forgive me, all the vegetarians in the audience. You can see the pig carcass hanging up there. It is obviously dead. It was dead before this happened. And we've got the kidneys here, which we also collected. And here we've got the entrails in a stainless steel container. And we got all of the entrails. So we're looking inside the kidneys. So the kidney's been sliced open here to look for any adverse effects. This is the lungs, so you can see the deep slices in the lungs to go looking for problems there, such as pneumonia. And these are the entrails. So these are the intestines. You can see the large and small intestines, and we wanted to go looking inside all of that to see if there was any evidence of inflammation. But as you can see, there's an awful lot of them. And you'd have to slice open the entire length, wash out all of that stuff in the middle, and then go looking along the whole of the length of those intestines for any inflammation, and we just couldn't do it. But what we could do was look in the stomach. So we got those stomachs and we opened those up and washed them out and had a look inside. Now, what we found two major findings. Remember I talked about the problems in female reproductive health that was being seen in the pigs? Well, we found that on average, the weight of the uterus, which is the womb, of female pigs fed the GM diet was on average 25% heavier than the non-GM fed pigs. And that was highly statistically significant. That's what that p-value is there. Now, the males were neutered at 3 days of age. We don't quite know what might be happening with them. Now, what could be causing an increase in the weight of the uterus? Quite a few things. There are some unpleasant diseases that you can get that will increase the weight or the density of the uterus. They all have long names, and none of them you would want to have. Stomach inflammation, the veterinarians, before we did this study, went to the same abattoir, got pig stomachs from other farmers, from other pigs that were coming through, and they determined a measuring system based on that, where they determined what a nil inflamed, a no inflamed, a mild inflamed, moderate and severe inflamed. And once again, these veterinarians were blinded as to whether the pig stomach in front of them came from a GM-fed pig or not. So this is the guy looking in the stomach. So that's a pig stomach out there, and it's come from that numbered pig, and he's looking through all the folds, turning the folds over, having a look underneath, measuring the ulcers, measuring the size of the ulcers, if they're a bleeding ulcer or not. And the way they've been sliced open is if your stomach's like this, where the feeding tube, the esophagus, goes down into the stomach, it was opened this way and then opened flat. So you can see in the middle there, that's the esophagus, and that the red areas there are what's called the fundus. and he's assessing also the level of inflammation. And so this is the grading system that was used. That's an example, a typical example of a nil inflamed stomach. And you can see that this is sort of like a beige colour here. So mild, you're getting a little bit of red. There's moderate, getting more red. And that is that one is a severely inflamed stomach. And you can see that for that to be severely inflamed, almost all of the fundus has to be bright red, and it's also swollen, and obviously not the sort of stomach you would want to have. So what we found is that the type of diet that pigs get fed in the United States is sometimes does cause a bit of irritation in the stomach. So we found a low level of inflammation in pigs generally. But if you're fed the GM diet, it takes that and bumps it right up into the severe category. So that if you're a female, you're more than twice as likely to have that severe inflammation if you're fed the GM diet. If you're a male, you're four times more likely to suffer from that severe inflammation if you're on the GM diet compared to the non-GM diet. So what could the cause here be? We're thinking that the most biologically plausible thing are those BT proteins. The way they operate on the insect gut is that they cause pores to form inside the gut, and the gut actually ruptures. So in the insect. So we think that they might be having an irritating effect on the stomach. And remember that this GMAs contain two of these proteins, not just one, so they might actually be acting synergistically to create an overall effect. Now, we did also take some blood biochemistry a couple of days before the pigs were sent to the slaughterhouse, and we didn't actually find any difference on any of the measurements that we took. There are about 20 measurements in a standard blood biochemistry. No difference between the GM and the non-GM fed pigs. Now, this is interesting because, remember, we got that difference in inflammation and we got the difference in uterus size is not being picked up on the blood biochemistry results. Why? Because standard blood biochemistry, as the industry sometimes uses now in their animal feeding studies, doesn't have the measurements that can actually measure inflammation. So it doesn't include things like C-reactive protein. And it also doesn't have measures that might influence uterus size, such as estrogen or progesterone or testosterone, are not part of that standard blood biochemistry. So therefore, the standard blood biochemistry that the industry sometimes uses just can't pick this stuff up. It's just not good enough to do it. So in conclusion, you know, this mixed GM soy and diet and maize diet we found caused stomach and uterine pathologies. Now, humans have a similar digestive tract to pigs, so I think that there is a need to actually go looking to see if there's an increase in this sort of thing in people and whether GM crops might be the cause of that. But it's also my view that all GM crops should undergo long-term safety testing, long-term, on animals physiologically comparable to humans, not chickens, by independent researchers who have no vested interest in finding it safe or unsafe, before a GM crop is fed to a billion people, including GM crops containing stacked genes or expressing this double-stranded RNA. And in my view, these tests should include the four big ones, which is toxicity, reproductive health, allergies, and cancer. And I would just, oh yes, so more information you can get from this website here, gmogdcarmen.org. It's not actually my website, I don't run it, but it is a fan site and they're very good at putting up pictures of inflamed stomachs and also putting up copies of all the papers we've published, as well as those clear English statements on there as well as when we get attacked by people associated with the GM industry about how it couldn't possibly be due to the diet that we found these results, then you can see all of our rebuttals up there as well. So that's rebuttals written by me and by other people. And if I could, I'd just like to finish up by talking about labelling. Oh, by the way, I can spell. That's how we spell it in Australia. So I just want to talk about labelling. Australia has labelling. We've had it for a very long time. The European Union has also had it for a long time. They've had it for 18 years, which is getting on towards a generation that you haven't had it. And, you know, I can tell you stories as well as how we were told that the sky was going to fall in and the cost of food was going to go through the roof if GM labelling came in. Didn't happen. Didn't happen in my country, in New Zealand, across the European Union. In fact, in any of the 64 countries that actually have laws requiring labelling. I'm not aware of it happening anywhere there. And why, in fact, label? Well, I do believe you have a right to know. And it's, as an Australian, I know the United States government lectures other countries about democratic rights for its citizens. So I find it ironic that they then deny you one of the most basic democratic rights, its own citizens. But also for epidemiological studies. You see now, if you want to do a study on people in the community to see whether GM crops might be causing, or a particular type of GM crop might be causing a particular type of harm, what you've got to do is you've got to look inside people. You've got to basically assess where they've been exposed to that GMO or not, to then work out whether they are getting the disease because of the GMO or not. You've got to compare rates of exposure and rates of disease. Now, how can I, as an epidemiologist, do an epidemiological study on you guys if I have to ask you, have you been eating this GMO? You can't tell me, can you? Because it's not on the label. And I could go to the food manufacturers and ask them, but they don't know either because they don't have to. So for the need for epidemiological studies later on, I would think that it was a fairly useful thing and an important thing to actually have labelling of GMOs in the United States. Thank you.
Dr. Judy Carman, please give her a warm thank you. So our next speaker. I will look into that immediately, yes. And we will have, I should mention, we will have a question and answer session once our final speaker is done for all the speakers. So our next speaker, our final speaker, is Dr. Stephanie Seneff. She is a senior scientist, research scientist at MIT, who holds degrees and background in both biology and computer science. She, since 2011, has written over a dozen papers regarding various health topics. And I think because of her background in biology and computer science, she is able to connect the dots and do research that nobody else in the world is doing in terms of correlating all this data that is available. And so she also gave a very interesting talk last night. I'm expecting it's going to be a fascinating talk as well. Looking forward to what she has to say. I hope you enjoy it. Please give a warm round of applause to Dr. Stephanie Seneff.
Hello, can you hear me okay? Thank you all for being here. I very much appreciate it. Let me get set up. This mouse is always hard to find. We're all having trouble with this computer. Sorry. I was afraid of this. I knew this was going to happen. This is not my computer, so I'm not. The mouse is being
perverse. Maybe everybody can stand up and stretch for a second.
See it. Do I? This is very unusual.
Having some technical difficulties here, but we're listening hopefully very soon to Dr.
Okay,
Stephanie Seneff.
Machine. We can't seem to get the mouse to come to life here. Oh, did you get it? Are you just going to boot? All right, so my name is Stephanie Seneff, and I work at MIT, Senior Research Scientist, and I'm here to tell you about glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in the pervasive herbicide Roundup. Most of you probably believe that glyphosate is very safe because the U.S. government assures us that that's the case, and it's claimed that Monsanto has done significant studies in the early 1980s to prove that glyphosate is safe. And therefore, it is the most pervasive herbicide on the planet. And people can go down to the hardware store and buy it and use it to kill the weeds in their yard. And the industry has come up with these GMO Roundup Ready designed crops, the core crops of the processed food industry, the soy, the corn, the canola, the sugar beets, the alfalfa. And these crops go into the processed foods that make up the bulk of the foods that people in this country are eating. This is the most significant GMO gene available on the market. And the gene allows the plant to survive when the Roundup is sprayed on it. And this means that the Roundup gets into the food. And because it's considered so safe, the U.S. government does very little monitoring to see if the Roundup is actually there. And so we're in a very dangerous situation because of this. And I think we're in business. Thank you for your patience. I was actually expecting this mouse to mess up, but I didn't expect it to mess up that badly. Okay, but we're ready to go. Uh-oh. Oh, no. Oh, there we go. Okay, never mind. So my talk is glyphosate, the safe herbicide that's making us all sick. And if you want to see these slides, in fact, there's additional slides at this webpage in addition to this main talk, a longer talk, if you will, that you can load from my webpage, people.ccell.mit.edu/seneff. And I have several other sets of slides there on that page, as well as many papers that I've published with colleagues, many of which are about glyphosate. So if you want to learn more, you can go browse my webpage and find other materials. I want to start with a quote. And this was a quote from Stephen Drucker. He wrote a book called Altered Genes, Twisted Truths. I just finished reading that book, and it is outstanding. I recommend it to all of you. It will give you a sense of what Judy's talking about in her talk to see that this is indeed true across the world. It talks a lot about Europe as well as America and the lax regulation of the crops. He says, we don't need new laws. We don't need new research. We just need new awareness. All that's required is for a few key people or enough people in general to learn the basic facts. And when that happens, as it is bound to, it will bring the fact-averse GE food venture to an end. And I certainly hope he's right about that. So here's an outline of my talk. I'm going to start with an introduction. I'm then going to talk about gluten intolerance. We have an epidemic in gluten intolerance. People don't seem to be puzzled as to why that's the case. I am, and I think I have the answer. I'm going to talk about your gut microbes and their importance to your health and how disrupted gut microbes can lead to obesity. I'm going to talk about GM soy specifically and tell you why that's toxic food. Then I'm going to discuss cancer and the link to glyphosate. Anencephaly, which is a very rare disorder, defect in a child that's born with no brain. And then species and stress, mentioning a number of different species that are in trouble right now, which I think is in large part due to glyphosate, of course, as well as the other chemicals that are available on the foods. Finally, taking action. Okay, introduction. U.S. health status, one of the things I find very amusing is that you hear people say, oh, yeah, you know, the U.S., they've been eating GMOs for 2 decades, and look, they're fine. You know, and I say, we're not fine. And I don't know how you feel, but when I look around and I see all the problems that our children face today, the asthma, the eczema, the autism, the ADHD, the depression, the obesity, the diabetes, I mean, we are not fine. And in fact, we have only 5% of the world's population, but we consume more than 50% of the world's pharmaceutical drugs. So we're all drugged up. We spend more on healthcare than Japan, France, China, UK, Italy, Canada, Brazil, Spain, and Australia combined. And even China alone is a much larger country in terms of the population. We rank last or near last among developed nations on infant mortality and on life expectancy. And we are actually number one, the worst, the dead last, on death on the first day of life among the industrialized world. We also suffer from more chronic illnesses, and we consume 25% of the world's supply of glyphosate. 5% of the population, 25% of the glyphosate. You do the math. So I told you about Stephen Drucker, Altered June's Twisted Truth. It's a great book. And he's showing that we're recklessly subjecting our health and the health of the environment to unacceptable risks with these GMO crops. And they're not based on sound science, but they're rather based on an evasion of the standards of science. And for over 30 years, esteemed institutions have systematically contorted the truth in order to conceal the risks. So this is pretty damning statements that he's making in this book. This is what got me worried 8 years ago, looking at the trends in autism in the United States. When you look at the far left, it's 1975. That was when glyphosate was first introduced into the food chain. At that time, we had 1 in 5,000, the rate of autism. That's been going up very dramatically, and the most recent number coming out of the CDC was 1 in 68 in 2014, a very big change. And the shape of this curve is exponential. And this is what has me concerned, because exponential growth is very scary. I started looking at autism 8 years ago. I was frustrated because most of the research dollars are going into genetics. And I think this is not a genetic problem. I will say that certain kids are genetically more susceptible, and they're the ones that are going to get it first. But as you get more and more poison in the environment, more and more kids are going to get autism, and that's what you're seeing. It's an environmental problem with a genetic susceptibility factor. And so the question is, what is it in the environment that's causing it? And so 8 years ago, I started looking, and I looked at a lot of things, aluminum, mercury, lead, PCBs, POPs, all these things. And I was frustrated after 5 years of looking that I knew I didn't still did not have the answer, because I understood what autism was. And it's a very complicated condition with a lot of comorbidities, things like gut disruption, sulfur system messed up, a lot of things that I could not explain by the chemicals that I was looking at biologically. So 3 years ago, I heard a talk by Professor Don Huber. He's a retired professor from Purdue University, expert in plant physiology and plant pathology. And in that talk, he talked about glyphosate, and he said glyphosate is a huge problem. And he gave the evidence of the sulfur problems, the gut microbe disruption, all the things that I was seeing in the autistic kids that I couldn't explain. He explained all of them in that talk. And I went away convinced that I had now found the answer. And so I've devoted the last 3 years to studying everything I can about glyphosate, and I find my answer gets even more crystallized as I get more information. So I feel very confident that I'm right. It's not that glyphosate's the only thing that causes autism, but it's what's causing the epidemic. So this is exponential growth, 1 in 68. That's kids who are 12 years old at that time, 12 years old in 2014. What about kids that are being born today? We've got to extend this curve into the future by 12 years. If we do that, where are we? What's the number? Well, you can figure this out pretty simply using a little bit of math, because if this is exponential growth, then you can put it on a log scale and it should be a straight line. And in fact, you can see from this plot that it is. Now you can just extend that line into the future, and you can put up 50% and say, at what point in the future will half the kids born end up on the autism spectrum? You do the math and you get the number 2032. Less than 20 years from now, half the kids born, if we stay the course, we'll end up on the autism spectrum, 80% of the boys. And this is going to be devastating for our country if it actually comes true. So I want to stop this from happening, and that's why I'm here today. Big question, why? The answer, Roundup. Roundup, glyphosate is the active ingredient. It's a pretty simple molecule. It looks like that. Here's another plot of autism. This is the rate in the first grade. According to the U.S. system that allows for benefits for children if they have autism. And so it's very easy to collect the data in the public school system. And the curve, the blue boxes, are the rates of the autism in the first grade. Going back to the very left of the curve is 1990 over there. And then over here is 2011. And you can see that the red line looks extremely similar to the blue box. It's almost the same curve. The red line is the integration over the previous 4 years of the amount of glyphosate that was used on corn and soy crops in this country. Luckily, they're keeping a record of this. And the fact is that the two curves are essentially coincident. They're almost identical. The correlation coefficient is 0.99. 1.0 would be a perfect match. Incredibly good match between these two curves. Now, why is glyphosate usage going up so much on these crops? The reason is because they're developing glyphosate-resistant weeds. As you expose the weeds to so much glyphosate, because of the fact that the crop doesn't die, you're using it and exposing the weeds, and the weeds are developing an ability to resist the glyphosate too. And so you have to use more and more Roundup to kill the weeds on those GMO crops. Here's a quote from Dr. Robin Ménage. She's written many papers discussing the dangers of glyphosate. Glyphosate is everywhere throughout our food chain, in our food and water. The lack of data on toxicity of glyphosate is not proof of safety. And these herbicides cannot be considered safe without proper testing. And you saw from Judy Carman's talk that there's no proper testing on the GMOs. There's also no proper testing on the herbicides. We know Roundup contains many other chemicals, so they put extra ingredients in order to make it more toxic to the weeds. And so those chemicals, when mixed together, are 1,000 times more toxic than glyphosate on its own. So this is pretty striking. You know, they only